Well, I have an announcement to make. Have you got that frame up there, the one with the five on it? It just suddenly hit me yesterday that today is our fifth anniversary. Today. Yeah! Can you believe it? They said it would never last. May 20th, 2007 to May 20th, 2012. It's almost hard to remember. Those of you who are with us down in the harbor in the boathouse, it was such an amazing, it was such an amazing setting. Brennan still talks about it. He was only two when we started there, and we were there for only a year and a half, but he still talks about going back to the other church. He wants to go back to the other church. Yeah, baptisms are easy. You can just walk right down to the beach and go into the cold water there, except when the Peligroso signs are out and stay out of the water. It's like, oh my gosh. A lot has happened in 5 years. There's been so much going on. I think that first Sunday when I sat here to do this and give the message, I told everybody that, you know, South Orange County needed another church like it needed another Starbucks. I guess since then there's a lot fewer Starbucks, but no fewer churches. But what we tried to do when we started The Effect was make sure that we had a reason to exist. That was the most important thing for us. If we were just starting another Sunday community church, well, there's one on practically every corner. But to be a recovery community, to be a group of people who have something specific to do in the community that can help the community, that can help people who have gotten off track to find a way to get back on track, a community that can hold them there long enough that they can get deep into their spirits this amazing understanding of the Father's love and how it works. If that was our purpose, and by the way, we also worship together on Sunday mornings, that was the right perspective. And, you know, to our credit, more or less, we've been able to do that. You know, we've gotten off track a few times ourselves, and we've certainly had our share of bumps and bruises and knocks down to our knees. But we keep showing up, and that's been the beautiful thing about this. Some of you know, some of you don't know, we're growing upstairs. We've established a counseling center and an outpatient treatment center. And as of May 1st, we took a second suite up here. And so that is continuing to grow. It's another huge part of our work that complements what's happening downstairs as well. And so just here to thank God that we've had 5 years and all of your support and people's support financially and in terms of sweat equity has made this all possible and has made it an amazing thing. It was interesting that we had Chris Falson here on Friday, as Pastor Frank mentioned. And whenever I know there's someone new, like Lindsay's here new, I always, for the first time, I tend to see everything through their eyes. You know, it's kind of like you never realize how dirty your house is until the guests are coming. It's a lot like that. Yeah. All of a sudden, I'm seeing everything. Okay, now what would they think of it? It was so wonderful. Here's Chris Falson. I've been playing Chris Falson's music in worship teams for 20 years, and he was just a name on sheet music to me, you know. And then we got a couple of his discs, and we heard him play. But to actually meet the man and to be able to play with him was just an amazing, amazing experience and such a privilege. But the first thing he said when he walked in, and we do hear this a lot, he says, "I just feel a warmth here." That last song we just sang, "I feel the warmth, I feel the presence." And he felt that, and he commented on it as soon as he walked in the door. And the night just unfolded that way. And he had a lot of things to say about what he was feeling about The Effect. He had already read through our website, and he knew something about us on a technical side. But as he was sitting here, one of the things that Chris does is he goes with his visions and images and things that occur to him as he's playing music, and he speaks them out. And one of the things he said is that he looked out and he saw the courtyard paved with gold, and he said, "How extravagant that is." But he just felt that there was going to be this outpouring of something, you know, whatever that gold represents. But he could feel that, and he felt the connection and the sense of community here. You know, if we have achieved that, then we've achieved something. And there's been no wasted time in these 5 years. And I am so grateful to be a part of this and so thankful for everyone who has helped us just keep this thing going. You know, I don't know about words of knowledge and prophetic utterances. You know, I've seen as many of them come to pass as not. But I do know this. We're going to just keep showing up. That's what we do. We show up. And in the showing up, connections happen, synapses fire, stuff goes forward, and you just don't know which way it's going to go necessarily. And thank God, I don't want to know. That's too much information for me. You know, if I knew or thought I knew what was coming, I would just muck it up anyway. So thank God for the unknowing as we move forward and showing up, trying to love each other. And that's the key. It's showing up and really being present. Now, I got a confession to make. Friday, when I was heading over here to set up, coming early, like 4 p.m. to set up, I was running late. I was frazzled. I was in one of those moods. You know what those are. So I realized that I probably don't have enough gas because my gas gauge doesn't work. So I never really know how much gas I've got. But I'm thinking it's probably about time. And the worst thing that could happen right now is for me to run out someplace on Antonio. So I stop at the gas station. And wouldn't you know it, it's never full. Every single pump has a car in front of it. And there's a car wash right next to the gas station. It is full of cars. And they're streaming in and out. There's cars coming in the Jack in the Box. The place just looks like, you know, some sort of crime scene with all the people descended on it. I think, oh, Lord, you know, I got to go. And so I'm sitting there and I'm getting tenser. I can feel my hands tighter on the wheel. I'm looking for who's going to be first. Okay, so someone pulls right out and I got my gas gauge on the right-hand side. So I pull in and the person is facing me at the next pump and they're watching me. Okay, how close is he going to get? You know, is I inching up because I'm trying. It was just this tense experience. I'm pumping the gas. I'm trying to get out. I finally get back in the car, and I'm ready to go. And there's so many cars coming in. I'm sitting there waiting for about 8 cars to pass. I turn around. I'm finally inches from a clean getaway, just about to hit the driveway to get back on the street. And out of the gas station juts this little car right in front of me, cuts me off. I hit the brakes, and I'm just about ready to do something I would regret. And my van sits pretty high, so I'm looking down at this car right in front of me. And all of a sudden, here comes this face pasted right on the window, looking up at me. And I can see it's a Down syndrome young man, maybe in late teens, probably early 20s, with thick black rimmed glasses on and a white shirt that I realize is the uniform that they wear at the car wash. So he's one of the car wash employees. And obviously, he was functional enough that he could drive the cars, you know, from the car wash place over to where they dried or detailed and did other things. And he's looking up at me, and he's got this face-splitting grin, ear to ear, you know, and he's waving hard like this. He's just like, you could almost hear him saying, look at me, I get to drive a car. He was so excited. Everything just drained out of me at that moment. And I thought, how stupid am I? You know, all these things I'm worried about, he gets to drive a car, and he is on top of the world, you know? And it just hit me. It struck me in that moment. And I was able to just deflate the balloon, you know, and get down off my high horse and just realize all these things that I take for granted. I was getting to go play with Chris Falson. I get to sit here and play music. I get to talk to you all. I get to counsel. I get to do all these things. And I'm irritated because the parking lot is full. I mean, you know, we do this all the time. We lose our way. We lose our presence. We lose our sense of proportion and connection. And it took this young man to just bring it all in my face. You know, remember when Marion was pregnant with Brennan? And she was in her early 40s at the time, because we were a little bit later in life, kind of surprised. And she goes in to have her initial checkup, and the nurse tells her that she's pregnant. And the first thing or the next thing out of her mouth is, do you want to keep it? Looking at her as in her 40s and realizing that there is a possibility of Down syndrome, there's a possibility of spina bifida, do you want to keep it? Marion was shocked. You know, what kind of a question do you ask? But really, that's sort of the cultural imperative attitude, I suppose, of our times. What's the definition of a pointless life? Is it a life that is Down syndrome? Is it a life that doesn't meet the outcomes or the expectations or the plans that we have for it? Whether it's the life of our child or whether it's the life that we lead on our own? We have to start redefining what pointless means, because our definition is going to have everything to do with the experience of our moments, how we live those moments. Marion came home and told me the story, and we had to decide, you know. They wanted us to do an amniocentesis and find out whether, you know, there was any problems with the child. And we finally looked at each other and said, you know what? We're keeping this child no matter what. It just doesn't even matter. So why even bother? I stick that needle in there. Ew. You know? So we didn't have the amnion. Of course, he came out perfect. But there was a moment as we were deciding this, those few days that we were talking about it. And I was in another parking lot, and there was a Burger King right there. And this girl came in with her bike and put it in the bike rack, and she had on a Burger King uniform, and she locked up the bike, and I'm just sitting there waiting for traffic to subside, and she came out, and she was Down syndrome. But she had a job at Burger King, and she was doing what she does, and she walked in, and I realized at that moment that I could love her if she was my daughter. You know, I could do that. I could care for her. I could see in her life something that had a point and not something to be discarded. And all this is kind of flooding, you know, in my mind that Friday afternoon and in the days since, because I get off track. I get lost in the details. I get lost in all the things out there that I've got to do and get done, and the things, the goals, and the milestones that we want to hit. And I forget about what's happening right here and right now. And this is a big reorientation that we have to do daily. This stuff doesn't last. You ever notice that? Get all prayed up one day and, man, it should sit on the shelf for at least a week, don't you think? It just doesn't work that way. Every single day, we need to get in touch with our lives and the source of that life so that we realize that these things are not pointless. These things are sacred, every little mundane detail, you know? And so as I was thinking about this morning and how we're going to redefine what pointless means and how this means in terms of our fifth anniversary and as we're going forward, what is the path that we take and how does that have a point and how does that have a goal and what does this all mean, those kinds of things. And I was thinking about Jesus' story of a woman who comes to him and breaks a alabaster vial of perfume and pours it all over his feet and all over his hair and in this extravagant, just gushing kind of, you know, paving stones of gold moment where she just lavished this is all on Jesus. And the disciples around him are just outraged. They say, this was expensive stuff. You know, we could have sold this and given the money to the poor. And, you know, that's a laudable goal. You want to help the poor. You know, how are we supposed to handle our resources? We need to be good, responsible stewards and all this. But Jesus' response is classic Jesus. You know, he tells them, you're always going to have the poor with you, but you're not always going to have me. And what she has done is to prepare me for my burial. What she has done is give me this incredible, extravagant gift at a moment that I really, really needed it. Because I'm going through some stuff as I look forward to what I'm going through. And this woman has met me where I am. That's not in the text, by the way. I'm just going with the flow. But you can imagine. And what Jesus is telling us and what he's giving us is this huge, huge principle, this huge concept. Because we get lost in the macro. We get lost out there someplace. The big picture. You know, I remember when I started working with Children of the Americas back in the early 80s, you know, 30-some years ago. And the statistic at the time that haunted me, that kept ringing in my head and was practically paralyzing me, was that 50,000 children died each and every day due to malnutrition and vaccine-preventable diseases. Every single day, 50,000 kids. I was picturing that like Dodger Stadium, full of kids every day. And we go down across the border, and we were working around the edges of the garbage dump with the people who were gleaning there. And, you know, we'd bring them lunches, and we'd help, you know, a few dozen, maybe 100. And in that period of time, in that day, 50,000 children die. And what's the point? It's pointless. Why even bother? What are we doing? And for anyone who is going to be on the front lines of mission work or a first responder, you go through this dilemma. How do you stay present to the human tragedy that is life and hold on to your humanity and keep showing up to the moment and not flop down one side or the other to become so cold and callous because you had to distance your heart from the pain that you see and are immersing yourself in every day, or go to the other side where you become so connected to it that you're just a puddle on the floor and no good to anybody? walking that line in between is the difficult part. And Jesus is talking about that. Don't worry about the macro things that you can't control. They're out there. They will always be out there. The poor as a concept will always exist. But this poor person right in front of you has a chance if you are the kind of person who has prepared his or her heart to be moved into action when you come into contact with him or her. It's as simple as that. Jesus, as an individual man, needed something, and this woman filled that need, gave him a sense of connection. Had nothing to do with the poor out there as a block, as a concept. And he's trying to get us to understand these things. You know? How can we do that? How can we connect? I don't know if some of you were like really into the environmental movement at one point in your lives, or into the environmental movement now, or concerned with some cause out there. But in the 80s, I was a real tree hugger, you know, save the whales and save the trees. And I was a vegetarian for about 7 years during that decade. And what I remember most is being so overwhelmed by everything that was happening that I constantly felt guilt and shame. Anybody with me there? I mean, every time I'd flush the toilet, every time I put paper in a trash can, I'm thinking that's going into a landfill, that's going out to the ocean, you know, and I always felt guilty for everything that I consumed and everything I did, because I was adding to this big thing out there that was just so untenable and was destroying the planet. The pressure, you know, the guilt, everything was always on me. And then I transferred that over to Children of America's. You know, all these kids are dying, and what good am I doing? You know, it's difficult to negotiate. Jesus is giving us a window here about what has a point and what does not, where we can put our energy profitably and where we can't. You know, I want to read a couple of stories because I think they're really instructive about where Jesus is trying to take us in terms of redefining what's pointed and pointless in our lives. And you can read along with me at Luke 16, verse 1. This is one of those stories that is so difficult for us to understand. It just seems so uncharacteristic of Jesus. Actually, both of these do. That's why I wanted to bring them to your attention. I love the stories that just spin our heads around and we can't quite figure out, because those are the ones we really need to pay attention to. The ones we think we got all figured out, they're not going to move us. But one like this. Now, Jesus was also saying to the disciples, there was a rich man who had a manager. And this manager was reported to him as squandering his possessions. And he called him and he said to him, what is this I hear about you? Give an accounting of your management, for you can no longer be manager. The manager said to himself, what shall I do, since my master is taking the management away from me? I'm not strong enough to dig. I'm ashamed to beg. I know what I shall do, so that when I am removed from the management, people will welcome me into their homes. And he summoned each one of his master's debtors, and he began saying to the first, how much do you owe my master? And he said, 100 measures of oil. And he said, take your bill, sit down quickly, and write 50. Then he said to another, and how much do you owe? And he said, 100 measures of wheat. And he said, take your bill and write 80. And his master praised the unrighteous manager, because he had acted shrewdly. For the sons of this age are more shrewd in relation to their own kind than the sons of light. And I say to you, make friends for yourselves by means of the wealth of unrighteousness, so that when it fails, they will receive you into the eternal dwellings. He who is faithful in a very little thing is faithful also in much, and he who is unrighteous in a very little thing is unrighteous also in much. Therefore, if you have not been faithful in the use of unrighteous wealth, who will entrust the true riches to you? And if you have not been faithful in the use of that which is another's, who will give you that which is your own? No servant can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or else he will be devoted to one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and wealth. We could probably do a whole week or month on this. There's so much in here, but I want to focus on one aspect. And when I have talked about this passage before, there's always a million questions. And there's always people leaving not quite sure and unsatisfied about the explanation of certain things. But I want to focus on this one aspect for today, because this is where we're at. The key to understanding what Jesus is talking about, because it seems like he's praising unethical behavior. Is he praising an embezzler? Is he praising someone when he's caught in the embezzling that now he's going to give away more of his employer's wealth in order to save his own skin? Is that what Jesus is talking about? Because it doesn't sound like Jesus. But the key to understanding this passage is understanding this concept of unrighteous wealth. And wealth there is probably not a good translation for the word that stands in the original Aramaic and the Greek that follows. In fact, newer Bibles now are leaving it untranslated. They're just saying mammon, unrighteous mammon. And that's probably a good thing, because the word mammon, untranslated from the Aramaic, refers to a mamona, which was the deity, the female deity of wealth, but also of greed and avarice. And the full understanding of what mammon represents is anything that you pile up in your life that comes to define you. Okay? That can be money. That can be physical wealth. But it can be anything that you identify with. Anything that you pile up, that you guard, that you trust in, that you keep secure, that eventually becomes your identity. It defines you. The tail starts to wag the dog. Every one of us has something that we've been clinging to. Something that is our security blanket. Maybe it is our bank account. Maybe it is all those zeros that make you feel that you've got a hedge against the uncertainties of life. Maybe it is your skills, your accomplishments. You know, maybe it's your looks. Whatever it is, family, nothing wrong with family. But Jesus also said, you know, unless you can reject your father and mother and sister and brother, you can't follow me. Unless you love them less, hate them, right? So he's still talking about this question of identity. Where do you place your identity? So we need to expand this idea of the mammon, because it can be anything that we are holding on to. But here's where it really tweaks us. The unrighteous mammon, the unrighteous wealth that is being described here, to us sounds like the wealth that is unrighteously obtained. He obtained it unrighteously, right? Through embezzlement and other subterfuge. But to Hebrew thinking, the unrighteous mammon was not the wealth that was unrighteously obtained. It was the wealth that was unrighteously retained. Do you get the difference? It was what you held on to. It's what you clung to. It's what you put your trust in, your faith in. It's what you didn't let flow. The idea of God's Spirit, like we've said so many times here, is always in motion in Hebrew. Ruach literally means breath and wind and spirit all at the same time. It has to move. It has to flow. If it's not flowing, it's not God's Spirit. Everywhere God's Spirit is described in the Scriptures, it's in motion. And if it's not in motion, it's not God's Spirit. If we are going to be in motion with God's Spirit, then our resources have to be in motion too. I may have used this analogy before. Have any of you ever been in a hot air balloon? Okay, a couple of you. First and only time I went in a hot air balloon, I was shocked, because I thought we were going to get up there and the wind would be blowing all over the place. You get up in a hot air balloon, I see Tony's head shaking. No, you get up in a hot air balloon, it's like sitting in your living room with the doors and windows shut. It is completely still. And it shocked the heck out of me. How could this be? And then all of a sudden it hit me. Duh. The wind is blowing the balloon. We're all moving in the same direction and speed. And so everything is completely still. You can sit up there with your, you know, your sack lunch and you could be just fine. Wouldn't ruffle a hair out of place. When we are moving with God's Spirit, that's what we feel. That centeredness. That connection. If there's a gale force wind in your face, you can say, well, you're doing something contrary, you know, to what direction and speed God's Spirit is moving. It's the flow that's important. It's being in the flow that's important. Our resources come into us through our hard work, through what we do. We use what we need for the day, just like the Lord's Prayer says, give us the bread of our need this day, directly translated from the Aramaic. And the rest flows on by. To do what? To float somebody else's boat higher. Oh, does that mean I don't have an IRA? I don't have an insurance account? No, of course. We need to be responsible for our family. But is your heart the one that's prepared to let your resources flow to the person in front of you when they're in front of you? To allow it just to go. To not be too afraid. Oh, this is my last 20. I don't know if I'm, you know, All those things that we worry about and think about. What is he going to do with this money? You know, sometimes you just let it flow. And what Jesus is saying is that the sons of this age, the people of the world, the people who act shrewdly, the ones who have, they know how to create a soft landing for themselves. They know how to ingratiate themselves with other people so that when their resources run out, when they hit hard times, then someone will take them in. But what Jesus is saying is that on the spiritual level, this works exactly the same way. If everybody's resources are flowing, then there's never going to be a time when they're not flowing to you. They flow to you. They flow out to somebody else. Theirs flows to them and flows to you when you're in need. And everything is in motion. And everybody's needs are met if we would just not dam up the flow. Don't stop the flow. Keep it going. This is what Jesus is talking about. It's a condition of the heart. It's how we live. It's the attitude that we have toward life. It's the fearless experience of life that can occur when we realize who our Father really is. And this is what Jesus was trying to get across. We cannot lose because of who our Father is. And once we start to know that, we can let things flow and not fear. The next story is similar. Matthew 25, starting at verse 14. For it is just like a man about to go out on a journey, who called his own slaves and entrusted his possessions to them. To one he gave 5 talents, to another 2, and to another 1, each according to his own ability. And he went on his journey. Immediately the one who had received the 5 talents went and traded with them and gained 5 more. In the same manner the one who had received the 2 talents gained 2 more. But he who received the 1 talent went away and dug a hole in the ground and hid his master's money. Now after a long time the master of those slaves came and settled accounts with them. The one who had received the 5 talents came up and brought 5 more talents, saying, Master, you entrusted 5 talents to me. See, I have gained 5 more talents. And his master said to him, Well done, good and faithful servant. You were faithful with a few things. I will put you in charge of many things. Enter into the joy of your master. Also, the one who had received the 2 talents came up and said, Master, you entrusted 2 talents to me. See, I have gained 2 more. And his master said to him, Well done, good and faithful servant. You are faithful with a few things. I will put you in charge of many things. Enter into the joy of your master. And the one who also had received the 1 talent came up and said, Master, I knew you to be a hard man, reaping where you did not sow and gathering where you scattered no seed, and I was afraid. And I went away and hid your talent in the ground. See, you have what is yours. But his master answered and said to him, You wicked, lazy slave. You knew that I reap where I did not sow and gather where I scattered no seed. Then you ought to have put my money in the bank, and on my arrival I would have received my money back with interest. Therefore, take away the talent from him and give it to the one who has 10 talents. For to everyone who has, more shall be given, and he will have an abundance. But from the one who does not have, even what he does have shall be taken away. Throw out the worthless slave into the outer darkness. In that place, there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. You. Do you see the same themes running through this, though, between these two stories? Does this sound like the Jesus we know and love? Taking away the little bit. I mean, at least he gave back what he was given, right? What's going on here? You know, it sounds so harsh. This line here, for everyone who has, more shall be given, and he will have an abundance, but from the one who does not have, even what he does have shall be taken away. This is a rabbinical saying. This is something that is repeated at least 2 other times at Matthew 13 and Luke 8. Jesus repeats that exact phrase, that exact line in different contexts. It's an important concept. If it's running through Scripture multiple times like that, you need to pay attention. It's an important concept. Jesus is trying to get something across here. The problem is, it looks like we're back to outcomes again, doesn't it? Each one of these 3 servants was given an amount of money, and they were judged, apparently, by the master on what they returned. What was their performance? What was their benefit there? And it looks like that's what's going on. But it's not where Jesus is going. It looks like there is some sort of outside doer who is giving and taking away. It looks like God, you know, that's being referred to here in this parable, is the one who is giving the talents, giving more abundance, taking away. But that's the wrong way to look at it. Because according to Jesus, the Father never withholds. The Father is always in flow. How could the Father withhold or dam anything up? He would be negating his own nature to withhold anything. It is always in motion, always in flow. There is never a time when God isn't flowing toward us. But think of this in terms of exercise and atrophy. What Jesus is really saying here is those who exercise the flow, those who move out without fear, are going to gain in strength. They're going to gain in abundance. More things are going to come to them. Just like someone who exercises and gains physical strength, gains more energy. And of course, the opposite of that is atrophy. The less that you use this, or if you stay completely sedentary, if you stay completely still, immobile, even what you have is lost. Basically, Jesus is saying, and the rabbis before him and around him were saying, you use it or you lose it. But God isn't doing the giving or the taking away. It is our interaction with the flow that is taking us there or leaving us behind. Once again, and always, it's our choice. We get to choose what we want to do, to move into God's flow, to see the benefits, to see the abundance and the increase, or to lose what we even have. You know, it's so important for us to see that. In Ecclesiastes, there's a line, cast your bread upon the surface of the waters, and you will find it again someday. This idea has run through Hebrew thought since the very beginning. You don't hold anything back. That's unrighteous mammon. Just cast it out there. Let it go. See what happens. Because it's always going to come back to you. You can't lose it. You can't lose. This isn't about outcomes. This isn't what Jesus is talking about. Because notice, the amount is not important. The one who gets five and brings back five, the one who gets two and brings back two, it's not important. At the end of the day, no matter when you arrive at the field to labor, you get paid the same, right? It's not about the outcome. It's about the moving forward. It's about the flow. This is what it's going into. We buy into this deceit that it's our accomplishment that matters. It's our accomplishment that has a point. And anything that doesn't have accomplishment, anything that doesn't have the desired outcome is pointless. But that's what we have to redefine. It's not that. We all get paid the same at the end of the day as long as we show up to the task. Otherwise, what we can accomplish just becomes another mammon to us, another thing that we pile up in our life and defines us. And the focus on the outcome keeps us in the fear. And the fear is what keeps us from the perfect love that would allow us to be free to cast our bread upon the surface of the waters. And the bread there, the lachma, is not just food and it's not just wealth. It's every source of provision that we need and that is available in our Father. So what's the definition of a pointless life or a pointed life? In the last story that I want to just bring to your attention, when Jesus is at the house of Mary and Martha in Bethany, and Mary's running around preparing the meal and doing what she does, trying to take care of everybody, and her sister Mary is just sitting at Jesus' feet and just lapping it all up. And of course, Mary gets irritated. You know, she's trying to prepare for the gig. And she complains to Jesus, and he says, no, leave her alone. She's chosen the better part. There is this constant balance between being and doing that we've got to negotiate as people. There's this constant balance between being responsible and moving towards some definable goals and discernible outcomes. We need to do that. But coming in for a landing and just enjoying the moments of our lives and not losing sight of really what each outcome is, which is right here and right now. Being in the flow doesn't mean inaction. It means the action that we do is grounded in the moment, and that makes all the difference. I want to end by reading a short journal entry that I wrote, I think, 20 years ago. And I know I've read it in here before, but I love coming back to it at intervals because it speaks to me, and I hope it speaks to you. I was on a business trip, and I was at an airport. I think it was Boston. And I was just watching the people, and I was on one of those moving sidewalks, you know. And anyway, I wrote this. Women and their men. I see them all the time. Airport terminals are a good place to watch. The roles, the emotions, the language is universal. I see a young couple from the moving sidewalk coming toward me hand in hand. One of them has just arrived. I can't tell which. The small case he carries is nondescript. They talk. She is smiling, looks up at his eyes, back forward again, up, back. So much is said with her eyes. I can only imagine. I watch him. He is talking, but looks forward, she alternating at him and back ahead. What I see in her eyes, he hasn't seen as long as I watch. They pass, and I watch their backs. I see her profile tilted up to his face, but only the back of his head, minding the tiller. I've seen this before. Why is it so much easier for women to know where to look, where to keep their eyes, moving through their lives with their eyes fastened to the sides, on the eyes of those who travel with them? They're men more intent on destination, the negotiation of the journey. And how do women keep that look in their eyes as they search up into the profiles of their men? Last Wednesday night, we got a video of scientists trying to teach human language to apes and dolphins. You thought it would be great to watch the dolphins you saw in the pictures on the box, but were bored, as I knew you'd be, when I tried to talk you out of it. Even so, a segment stays in my mind. One man, a very famous scientist, spent 3 years raising an infant chimp and trying to teach him sign language. He named the chimp Nim. Nim did very well, learned several hundred signs. But funding ran out, the project was disbanded, and Nim went to a zoo or something like it. After reviewing hundreds of videotapes of his sessions with Nim, the scientist concluded that Nim was only imitating his teachers and hadn't really learned anything. Put a big dent in the chimp teaching business for a while. Several years later, the scientist went to see Nim. Hadn't seen him since funding ran out on the project. In clinical voiceover, he wondered if Nim would remember him. The video camera caught Nim walking with the trainer just as he caught sight of the scientist. Immediately, chimp screeches filled the TV speaker at the rate of about 3 per second as Nim threw up his arms and sprinted, as well as chimps can do in their loping way, for the scientist who got down on his haunches and braced for impact. Nim leapt into the scientist's lap and threw his arms around his neck. Chimp arms being what they almost went around twice. All this time, and for as long as the camera held on Nim and the scientist, chimp screeches never stopped or even slowed down, chimp teeth big and bright as the scene cut. And I kept hearing those screeches, and I laughed and smiled, and my eyes stung a little all at the same time, because the scientist thought that Nim had learned nothing, and Nim thought the scientist was his father, or brother at least, because the scientist was looking ahead at where he was going. Nim was looking at him. I'd rather be a chimp than a scientist. I'd rather be a young woman watching her man's profile than a young man watching the road. And I'd rather be a Down syndrome boy with a big smile driving a newly washed car than an irritated pastor on the way to a gig. Let's pray. Father, help us to redefine what's important in our lives. Help us to see the sacred in the mundane, in the simple. Help us to realize that you are everywhere, and everywhere you are is a holy place, and we can take off our shoes because you are there. Help us to know who you are well enough to become free of the things that we cling to just let them down, put them down, let them flow. Help us to be free to just be with whomever we are, to help in any way that we can. Help us to know what that feels like. Father, with the next 5 years, the next 10 years, the next 20 years, whatever is granted to us as a community, we just ask that that would be the hallmark of who we are. That we are a group of people that create a safe space because we let your Spirit flow through us. We let our resources flow with each other. We hold each other and connect. That's what we want so badly, Lord. Thank you for these 5 years. Thank you for everyone who has come in these doors. Continue to bless them and their families. Continue to bless us and our families. In Jesus' name, amen.